There's a word, kind of a English word that's kind of I like to use sometimes. I don't use it so much in my teaching, but I like it for myself at least. Is often associated with this kind of practice we do in Western terms, and that's the word, the expression contemplative life, living the contemplative life. And at least in my mind, the association of that word is very much with monastic living, or going on a kind of spiritual retreat in a monastic kind of setting or monastic environment, or living a life that has a certain kind of time and quality to it that allows a person to have some kind of sense of spacious time to allow for something deep to happen, something maybe that's very shy inside of us or very quiet or very subtle to bubble up. That's be Buddhist terms, bubble up. In Western contemplative traditions, it might say, listen very quietly in order to be able to hear God. And but somehow to allow oneself a certain quality of attentiveness that is usually not available in daily life when we're running around being busy or being distracted or we have television or something. And so it's a little bit the kind of maybe flavor of it if you go into a Japanese tea garden, for example, and feel very, very peaceful and serene. When I was 18, I visited Mont Saint-Michel. It's a famous kind of monastery in France. And I was given a tour of the place, and it was built, the whole big monastery was built around a simple chapel, one-room stone chapel on top of this hill. And in the tour, we were led into the chapel. And as soon as we walked into this chapel, I was transformed. Something happened to me, or some kind of peace and well-being kind of filled me. That was very, very rare in my life. And then I kind of let the tour leave, and I kind of stayed behind to kind of soak in this wonderful feeling of well-being, of peace, of serenity. It felt very full, very complete, kind of feeling of being complete. So the word contemplative, one of the ideas of its etymology is that it means comes from the word in the temple or with the temple. So temple means something sacred. So to be with what's sacred. And in Western contemplative or monastic traditions, there is the order of Saint Benedict, and the first word in the rules of Saint Benedict in Latin is ascolta, or in Italian, I don't know what it's probably written in Latin, but ascolta in Italian means listen. The first word is listen. And I don't know the rest of it, so maybe he has something else in mind, but I just love the idea that listen is the first rule. Listen. And so there's a marvelous story from the Mahabharata of the god Rama going into the forest with his companions and hearing a very faint voice calling his name. And he asks his companions, "Do you hear that voice?" And they say, "No." But so he goes and follows the voice until he comes to this big boulder. And when he comes to the boulder, he listens really closely. And in fact, he still hears his name being called out from the boulder, Rama, Rama. And then he takes both hands and he places them on the boulder. The boulder breaks open, dissolves or something, and out of it comes a wonderful lady. And her name is Alaya. And she explains that a long time ago she was bewitched or something happened to her, and a witch put her in this boulder and locked her in there until someone like Rama came and freed her. So I don't know, you know, exactly what the traditional interpretation of the story is, but what I make out of it that's meaningful for me is that often we often hear a voice, hear something, urge, some inspiration, some aspiration, and it can be very faint. And the idea that no one else can hear it is very important. That you know, it's something that's really our own. You know, and sometimes parents and friends and family don't even support going towards that faint, intuitive perhaps, or sense of a possibility of a new way. Remember the lady's name is Alaya. And Alaya in Sanskrit means home. So it adds a certain flavor or depth to the story that what gets revealed or discovered is home. So anyway, there's this kind of calling to home or calling to something. And we have that English expression, a calling. And what does it take to hear or learn one's calling? So he follows it. He follows the voice, and we follow ours, and we come often to some kind of obstacle. And maybe there are parts of ourselves that have been petrified or frozen and are very difficult. And through that difficulty, we can still hear that voice calling us. And then I love it that Rama puts both hands on the boulder. To me, he doesn't take a sledgehammer to it. He doesn't say, well, it's a boulder, so it's too hard, walks away. He just, you know, puts his hands very gently, maybe lovingly or peacefully, just puts it there to really make contact and be present for what's going on there. So in the same way, it's kind of rare in our human life to have the opportunity for some kind of quality way of really touching ourselves with awareness, touching some inner place that maybe really needs to be touched, really needs to be have our presence, and do it with time, with plenty of time, contemplative time, extended time, where we don't have to go get up and go shopping or take care of the kids or go to work. Or there's a lot of things in our life that can be very busy. But just, you know, contemplative life is one that allows for a lot of time that in modern economic terms is very inefficient. And so it's not very popular. But it's probably essential for our hearts, for something inside of us to have that kind of time. So in a kind of quality time to be able to touch ourselves, be present for ourselves. And in that presence, the extended contact, something else can happen. What is that something else? And one of the suggestions in the story, it's home, coming home. And for some people, it's quite rare to be at home, even at home. At home, in my mind, associations of the word, is a place where you don't have to be apologetic. You don't have to defend yourself. You don't have to build yourself up and prove yourself in any kind of way. You can just be yourself. You can, you know, walk around without any socks on or, you know, in your underwear even, or pick your nose or, you know, whatever, you know, what's really you. You know, most people don't know you're a nose picker, but there you can just be who you are. But so home, you know, sometimes in meditation people say, I finally felt at home. I felt at home. I discovered what it's like to be home. And to do that in meditation is wonderful because then you can take your home with you anywhere you go. It's not place dependent. So to have some place we can go where we have this contempt, we can live the contemplative life, even if it's for a short time. And in many traditions, there is a custom, spiritual tradition, of people withdrawing from their normal life, and then after a period of time, then returning. With the cycles of withdrawal and return. And the idea of the vision quest, you go into do a vision quest to the Native American Indians, or 40 days in the desert, or there's many ways in which people do this. And in the Buddhist tradition, in ours particularly, the form we take is called retreats. We retreat. We retreat from our normal life. Not because we have aversion to it or we feel it's terrible, we shouldn't be there, but in order to allow something different to happen, we have to do something different. And so some people like the value of doing something different. Just like, you know, you go to the gym because you find that valuable, or you go to, I don't know, all kinds of things we do. That's different than our normal life because it's beneficial and helpful. So we retreat from what's normal, and we step out of the normal social conditionings, normal social relationships, normal social positions we have in society. And we allow a lot of things that are normal and normal fill our consciousness and mind, concern us, we can allow them to drop away. And even before you start meditating, to go in an environment where you can drop away so many of the identities we have and concerns we have and social relationship, kind of ways we relate to people, is really amazing. So then we go there and we listen. And on retreat, there's a variety of things that can happen. And this is not a comprehensive list, but I'll just mention a few. Retreat is a time to de-stress. And we have a culture, or it seems to be contagious, right? Being stressed out and being over busy. And so go someplace where we can have some extended period of really deep de-stressing. And what amazes me is the degree to which deep meditation practice, especially on retreat, allows for a de-stressing process that's really, really deep. I mean, it's deeper than you would ever imagine if you lived a relatively calm life. When I was in the monastery, I used to be surprised that I'd wake up in the morning, you know, refreshed, ready to go, and then we'd meditate two sessions of meditation, and I would be more calm than when I woke up. You know, I hadn't even done anything yet. You know, I just got up and washed my face and went and meditated. But meditation allowed me to get the deep access to deeper levels of calm or well-being than even when you first wake up. So the same thing applies to retreat. So it allows for kind of a very deep de-stressing, unwinding process. And that's the first thing. Another thing that happens on retreats is that we get to discover ourselves in whole new ways. And it's not uncommon that one of the first things we discover about ourselves is things that is not good news. Someone said self-knowledge is seldom good news. And we discover some of the common habits, what makes us operate, some of the fears or the desires or the greeds or the judgments or the criticisms or the planning mind. Or we learn all kinds of things about ourselves, or unresolved issues, or unresolved, you know, things. All these things kind of show themselves, because as consciousness relaxes, it's going to kind of meet these layers of places where things are unresolved. And so there's a period of time where, and I think almost all contemplative traditions talk about meeting your demons. Not that they're necessarily demons or that bad, but there's meeting sides of yourself that maybe you'd rather not meet. And part of the value of these wonderful retreats is to meet parts of yourself that you'd rather not meet. So why should you go? Someone recently reminded me of the story of the Earthsea trilogy and Ged, you know, being chased by this shadow and then chasing the shadow himself and then finally realizing the shadow and him were the same. Nice Jungian story. So meeting ourselves. But then on the other side of that is also meeting what's beautiful about ourselves. And one of the things I see over and over again, I teach many retreats, is a retreat environment, meditation retreat environments, is where the best in people comes out. And I feel so fortunate to be so frequently in environments where I see the very best of people. And sometimes people even tell me, you know, oh, you know, you see me only partially, you know, really I'm not so good, you know, out there, you know. So I know that out there, you know, people live different kinds of lives. But it's really a privilege to see, you know, something about that environment where people try to be mindful and be present and relax and be contemplative seems to pull out and draw out the best in people. So you see tremendous kindness and compassion and warmth and sense of well-being. And so retreat's a place to discover potentials that we have, potentials for these things, for compassion, for love, for peace, for letting go, for a variety of things. Retreat's also a time for being free. You know, the ultimate potential we have is to be free. So it's not only to develop our potential, develop our concentration, our mindfulness, and these different qualities we can develop, but to develop these qualities to a point where liberation is possible. And in the Buddhist tradition, not that you have to do this, be interested in this to go on retreat, but for the Buddhist point of view, the ultimate aim or the ultimate possibility of retreat kind of or the spiritual practice in Buddhism is liberation, is freedom. And freedom can certainly happen outside of retreats, but there's something about the quality of life on a retreat that makes it much more likely to happen there, much more likely to set the conditions there. Someone once said, liberation or enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. So it's, you know, it's not completely right, that expression. Don't take it as literal truth, but it's, you know, something to it. So going on retreat and allowing for something different to happen. And so these cycles of withdrawal and return, and then when we return, we hopefully come back differently. And depending on how deeply we've gone, how thoroughly we've immersed in that environment and been transformed, we come back more or less, you know, either more or less the same or more or less quite different. But the idea is we come back different. And there's many ways to talk about that difference. My own in my early practice was to talk about integrity. I discovered in my practice a sense of personal integrity that I never had in my daily life. And that's what I came back with, and I would lose right away. But then the quest, the spiritual quest, was how can I try to find or be that, have that integrity in my daily life that I feel in my meditation practice and on retreat. So then we come back in some way. And one way we come back is to borrow a Zen expression. We come back with gift-bestowing hands. With gift-bestowing hands. So we don't just simply retreat for our own sake, you know, but actually it's part of our offering to the world. We come back in such a way that our hands can offer gifts. Our hands can offer all kinds of gifts. Our hands, or hearts, or our minds, or our words, or something. But gift-bestowing hands. And so last thing I'll say about retreats is that a couple of people from IMC here went off to sit a 3-month retreat in the fall of 2001. So right after 9/11, they were a few days later, actually, they were off to go sit this retreat. And I made a point to go over to them and talk to them before they left. And I said, In the context of 9/11, that big tragedy, I can well imagine that you might be thinking that you shouldn't go, or there's more important things to do than going off and sitting silently on retreat for 3 months. And the world needs us at this point. This is a national and world crisis going on, and it seems maybe very selfish to go off and, you know, do your own little thing on retreat and meditate. And I said to them, I reassured them. I said, look, the whole world needs some people to go off and do that kind of deep contemplative work. Some people have to go and do that kind of contemplative work to show it's possible to purify the heart in that kind of deep way. And the world needs that as much as it needs all kinds of other things. But if some people don't show that possibility of purifying and enlightening the heart is not shown in the world, if no one manifests it, I think that our sense of what's possible, our potential as human beings, it's going to be hard to intuit it or feel it or see it. And have some people do it shows us all what we can all do. And I think it's a great gift that some people do it. Not that we all have to do it in the same way, but that people show it is possible, and we can be inspired, hopefully, not by them, but in them, in seeing ourselves, and seeing that each of us has a possibility and potential of feeling deeply at home, deeply at peace, deeply at ease in this life, free and liberated.